Welcome to Alchemical Dialogues, an Amber Light podcast. Join Dr. Henry Critella and Ode Shanae for their discussion on decolonizing into oneness. The information provided on this website and these podcasts is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this website and in these podcasts is intended to be a substitute for medical, health, therapeutic, diagnosis, or treatment. The opinions expressed by the guests in these podcasts are not necessarily the opinions of Amber Light International and anyone associated with this organization.
So welcome, everyone, and welcome, Ode. That's the only time I'm going to say your name other than Aziza Noor, because that's how I know you. So, everyone, it's a pleasure to interview my good friend, Dr. Ode Chesnaith, and thank you for agreeing to do this. So a little bit about you. You received your master's in social and solidarity economics from Université de Haute-Alsace, France, and your PhD in sociology from Colorado State, Colorado. Your spirituality is very important to you, and you found your Sufi family, which I'm also thrilled that you found, and we do a lot of work together. But your professional work, and really close to your heart, is working with Native communities. And you've done that in the U.S., you said, for the past 10 years. Working on issues of land sovereignty and traditional ecological knowledge, especially in support of regenerative food systems transitions. And a little bit of self-reflection you put in your bio, that you've had to strongly reflect on your positionality as a white researcher working in Indigenous settings and reconciling that with your spiritual quest to understand oneness, but realizing every day the need to commit to social justice and the real impact that human distinction has on people's lives, which I think is a really profound statement. The other thing I want to highlight, because I don't want to forget it later on, there's a website. You work for the Native Lands Advocacy Project that I think we'll talk about. And there's a dynamite website. The particular one that I reviewed is the storytelling. And it really gives a history that, in a fairly concise way, really shows what's happened with attempted genocide of the Native peoples, not just America, but not North America and also in Mexico, but concentrating primarily in the U.S. And it gave me a much better perspective on what we had talked about for this podcast, what decolonization really means. So I wonder if you could start with that. Traditional way most of us are probably thinking of that phrase, that word decolonization, but what it really means to you?
There is a lot of confusion about this term, especially among white people. And it's not surprising because it's related to our heritage as well, our human heritage. But the way that people usually understand decolonization is as a historical, chronological event on a timeline, right? That involved colonizing powers, mostly Europeans, leaving the colonies that they had settled on, genocide on, killed, raped, and stolen resources from, and eventually left after wars and conflicts and struggles that are usually not mentioned in history books, not to the full extent. But that's not what decolonization is or means, especially nowadays. Actually, if you want to be really specific, there's a term that explains what the difference a little bit better. It's the term of coloniality. What coloniality is, which is a difference between coloniality and colonization. Colonization is the process of colonizing in a place, stealing land, etc. Right? Coloniality is the enduring suffering resulting from that, the long-term effect, if you will. So by decolonization, we're not talking about simply about regaining resources, right? Or about leaving an area that's been colonized. We're talking about regaining full sovereignty on particular lands, regaining full control of a people's lives, on their livelihoods, on their way of thinking, on their worldviews, there's a tremendous amount of elements that come into play in that. And for people of color, these are very, very tangible stakes, right? Because a lot of people are still suffering from the byproduct of coloniality. They're suffering in terms of equality of treatment. They're suffering in terms of equal access to resources, to healthy lifestyles, healthy livelihoods. And in the case of Native Americans in the US, they're actually suffering from the tangible colonizing of their land because their land tenure is still managed and administered under colonial law nowadays.
So it's much broader than I had originally thought. You make your home now in Brittany, in France, and you had been in the US for 10 years, more than 10 years, right?
Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah. And can you tell us a little how you found your way to the United States and working with the Native populations here?
Yes, I actually went there. I went the first time to the US in 2009, and it wasn't at all to, you know, go and visit the States or because I had the American dream in mind or anything like that. I actually went the first time on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota, which is said to be one of the second poorest territory of the Northern Hemisphere. That's kind of the stereotypes. It's also full of resilience and amazing stories and great people with amazing projects happening there. But anyways, I ended up there with the idea that somehow we had lost so much our indigenous knowledge here that I was somewhat called to go and learn from these people. It was more about that. And it sounds a little stereotypical, but it was really a deep call for me that I had since I was a child, with a lot of signs and a lot of things coming to me, a lot of dreams, things of that nature, and eventually ended up there. And of course, you know, as a wake-up call, learn how to function as I said before, a white person and a white researcher on top of that in those particular lands.
So a little more about that. What were your particular challenges personally and in that work, being a white researcher and perhaps a white female researcher?
It's very interesting, you know, because when you go to graduate school, and they teach you how to do social research, you have this idea of neutrality, which obviously is put into question nowadays. And people know that modern ethnographers cannot be neutral in their field, you know, that they're full of who they are. And so therefore, that's what we call positionality. It's the acknowledgement, the understanding that you're not neutral wherever you go. So you come with the set of special circumstances that make up your identity, basically. But still in grad school, you still have this tendency to that research can be done in a fairly neutral way, explaining the purpose of your research and whatnot. When you go as a white person in a Native American reservation, you're entering a space in which your identity is inherently oppressive because data is still extracted from these people, because knowledge is still taken from these people, because their conditions of livelihood are not fully managed by themselves, for themselves, etc. And so a lot of people, even nowadays, being a white researcher in Native country, usually is not seen as a positive thing at all. So you're entering a space in which people see you as a potential extractor, as a potential colonizer, which you are, which most people are. And so you have to come with that in mind, and you cannot just come in and be, hey, I'm doing this research on this. Are you interested in participating? That's just, you cannot approach people like that. They have to understand that when you meet somebody, they have to understand that you're not an enemy and that you can potentially be an ally. And these are two separate things, and they add up to each other, basically. First thing, you're not an enemy. Secondly, yes, you can be potentially an ally and actually be of support to my community.
Can you give us an example of how you did that?
Sure. You find a tremendous amount of, well, there's a lot of literature on that, but it's nothing's worth the, you know, the personal experience of it. But I think, as far as I'm concerned, it came from the actual intention to want to understand the conditions and also to understand my positionality, meaning that my research was of little importance compared to the impact I had. I wasn't there because I wanted to make a name for myself or, you know, like become a researcher or anything like that. I was there because I was genuinely interested in understanding the local conditions and be of support if I could. And this meant first humbling myself about the potential positive impact I had, but also being fully aware of the negative impact I could have. on an everyday basis. And then just learning to be a person, be a human being, learning to relate to people, not as a researcher, but as a person. And it's through hard-won, long-term relationships that you actually gain trust and that you make people understand who you are and where your heart is. And eventually they see that, okay, well, this person has, you know, these and those skills. They're not here telling me something one day and leaving another. They're not here making promises that they're not going to hold. They're not here because they got a grant and then that grant's gone and they're going to be gone. And once they understand that, those people who are now your friends, they're not just people on a report or anything. They're actually your friends. What they say is also much more valuable, meaning that the information you're learning is actually important and interesting information. I mean, you know, it's one thing to want to come and do supposedly qualitative research, but you have to wonder, what is it that people are trusting you with? What type of information are they trusting you with? What type of information would you trust people with? You know, people come to your home and ask you a question about historical, you know, suffering. What amount and what truth would you be able to tell them if you don't have a meaningful relationship with them? So I think that's the most important, is to really operate with people on that human to human level and building these very important long-term relationships.
I take it they didn't teach you that in grad school.
No, they don't. I actually had a few fights with some professors back in the day. Well,
I was trying to think of a tactful way of asking you about that. Because what I hear you saying is that actually your interest in the people came first, and your research was a way of getting to know the people and finding ways of supporting what it is that they need, as opposed to the way I typically think of researchers, which is the research is the most important thing. And you had it reversed. Your research was a way of getting in to actually get to know people on a human level.
Right. And that's a very important point. And the second one is that at no point whatsoever did I wanted to know these people out of interest for people, for objects of studies or anything like that, you know. I think inherently I always knew that I would be learning more than I would be teaching, you know, and that this was a road. I'm talking more on a spiritual level here, right? But leaving a little bit of the research realm. But I think that when you develop these interests, you know, this research, purely research interest, it's more operating on an ego perspective where you are thinking of, you know, well, what kind of comparative advantage can I have extracting that information in this particular area with this particular people? Whereas, as far as I'm concerned, and I also know many people who operate on that other level, a lot of people in this group, I think, the idea there was I was really feeling a call that I would be learning valuable information that could potentially be useful, not just for people locally, but also for that I could take back to my own communities and apply there. And I'm thinking about traditional ecological knowledge here, but I really had in mind that there was something very, very special by the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, which I was confirmed very, very quickly in my trip, because from the very beginning, and contrary to what everything had been told about what a place of disaster it was, I could find this human resilience that expressed in so many different levels, from, you know, frugal innovation and so much innovation in the realm of regenerative agriculture and regaining control over severely degraded ecosystems, and so much innovation and so much force of character and strength and spiritual strength as well. From very early on, I understood that this journey was very much so about shutting up and learning. Shutting up and listening rather than, you know, extracting or teaching anything.
So what kind of blowback did you get from your grad school?
I think it expressed in different ways. One thing I was particularly surprised on, for instance, I came from a fairly different background. You know, in France, when you do that type of work, you're not supposed to publish, you know, right away. You're supposed to gain legitimacy. It's very hierarchical in a way, you know, it's the old European system. In the US, there's more of this get-go type of mentality, you know, where you have to be a super achiever right away. And by the time you finish your master's degree, you expect it to have, you know, 5 co-authored publications and so forth and so on. I never really understood that system. And so for me to be proficient in that was very complicated because it came in direct conflict with my work, because my work was about, well, what is it that I can learn about myself, but also to be better geared to support whatever the grassroots needs are. That was my work and my work stakes, you know, and academia was telling me, no, your stakes are, you need to come back, format this information in papers that nobody else but the academic circle will ever read. And that's how you're actually going to get a job. And so this was really, really conflictual for me, because this is something I was never able to do in great extent. I'm still struggling with that. I have a couple of publications. I never aim to publish in great journals or anything like that. I'm much more interested in the impact of the work that I do. And I understand that academia can have an impact, but definitely not the primary focus here.
How did you feel your being a woman affected your work, both in academia and with the Native populations you worked with?
Well, in academia, I think it's greatly confirmed and researched that, you know, being a woman, you have to work twice as hard just because you have much more to prove, especially when you're a young woman. There's issues of legitimacy, you know, when you're entering a classroom and you're teaching and people think you're not a student, and until then they understand you're the teacher and you're the one who's going to be teaching the class. So there's a lot of issues of legitimacy within academia. I think with being a woman, it's much harder to establish your credibility, for sure. As far as the field is concerned, I've never had, I would say my relationships with folks in Native country has been much smoother than in academia. I've always felt more comfortable in a room of people where I was the only white person than full of academics. And that's just me personally. But being a woman can be a little tricky if you don't understand the cultural codes, right? So in terms of the Lakota culture here, and I don't want to generalize to all Native nations because they're all different, but there are certain things traditionally that come with gender roles or gender norms that are slightly different. And so you have to understand those in terms of the norms. You're not supposed to look at people in the eyes, for instance, when you talk to them, it can be seen as aggressive or as disrespectful. When people older than you are speaking, you're supposed to, you know, of course, let them speak. There's a lot of norms that come subtly in terms of interacting with people, where you have to look at relationships a little bit more, or look at the encounter time as being a little bit more relaxed and on people's own time as well. So you can't, you know, just come in and start an interview, for instance. You just cannot do that. You really have to take the time. It's related to a concept called Indian time, which is real, where actually when you arrive on Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, it actually feels like time is slowing down in a way, because it is a different social time, and people understand that naturally, right? So it's within the long established relationships I was talking about that you have to find the meaningful times where you may talk about a specific topic, because it's interesting to people and they want to talk to you about it, but you cannot force anything, right? So there's really this awareness that need to develop, and also the awareness of these specificity when it comes to gender roles that are culturally specific.
So a lot of sensitivity and patience.
Yes, that's a good summary.
Not the mark of American academic institutions.
Yes, but weirdly enough, you know, I've seen that manifest tremendously. You know, I was really surprised talking about this publish or perish mentality I was telling you earlier, but to see, you know, young researchers, never been to the res before, showing up and interviewing a few people for a couple of weeks, just randomly, people they'd never seen before, and eventually leaving and presenting at conferences about the reservation as if they'd lived there and as if they, you know everything about it. And I was always tremendously shocked by that. And of course, it came in conflict with my tremendous reluctance to publish anything. But it was shocking to me to see that extraction mentality still vivid, and even in people who had good intentions.
So that's part of the decolonization process, is changing the attitudes of individual people.
Yes, that's part of what another movement, a little bit more in that vein, that's called Decolonizing the Mind. And I don't know if we talked about that previously, but Decolonizing the Mind is about, it's basically setting the assumption that relationships are colonized because of our identities, right? And our multiple identities. And that with awareness, we can attempt to question and deconstruct the power dynamics behind these identities. But it takes work. It's not something that's neutral. You can't just come in and assume that because your intentions are good, or you don't think as yourself as a racist or anything like that, that's going to be enough to do the work. You have to understand that who you are can be offensive even despite your intention, right? And once you understand that, you open another realm, which is a realm that a lot of people find uncomfortable. This is what researchers call something called white fragility, right? Once you enter that realm, you open the door of possibilities, because you can actually start looking for other types of relating to people that are beyond what you think you know of yourself, who you think you are, basically. But that's only attainable if you're willing to enter that discomfort and go beyond the discomfort. And decolonizing the mind is really a process that can help people do that, because it helps recognize coloniality in everyday life, and it helps recognize it in, you know, at the individual level, at the collective level, at a level of, you know, a session, a work group, anything. But it really can help demystify the process of decolonization and take out a little bit of the sensitivity out of it, which I think a lot of white people still are in that realm of, oh, well, my gosh, I don't need to decolonize. You know, I'm not responsible. It's not me. It was my ancestors who did this. You know, I don't have any responsibility. I don't have anything to do. And it certainly do not see that as part of the work. That's in a professional level. I think personally, it's also present in the spiritual work.
That's really profound. It reminded me, so as all of you know, I'm a psychiatrist, and I was in my child psychiatry training, because I did advanced training in child psychiatry. And it was a 2-year program, and it was my second year. So it was early in my second year, I think. And I interacted on an inpatient ward. And I think they were foster parents, but I'm not positive. And one of them very carefully, politely came up to me and said, I don't want you to take offense, but you don't act like a doctor. And could you please continue that? I really remember that. I'm not sure I did. I know there was another interaction where I don't think I did as well. And I could kind of see the disappointment. And I thought of that, and I wondered, I don't think I thought a lot about it. I picked up that they perceived a change in how I was interacting, and I wondered about that. I still do. But I also knew what they were talking about. I always thought as a doctor, I came from a middle-class background. My father and mother worked in textile industries for a long time and didn't have a lot of higher education. And I have never lost my middle-class background. I just know that. I mean, once I get talking, it just comes out of my mouth in terms of the way I talk and the way I interact with people. I could always feel the difference that would make with most of the people that I interacted with. It didn't help me in my academic pursuits. I wasn't a researcher like you are, and that wasn't one of my aspirations to be an academic psychiatrist. I really wanted to be a clinician, and thank God I never got into research, because I would have taken the field back many generations. But I could tell in some of the interactions that somehow I wasn't perceived at some level as some of my colleagues who had come from generations of doctors in their families and a lot of wealth and things like that. But for the most part, I think it really helped. So you're really making me think about it actually works on an interpersonal level. On a small scale, not just a big scale. And I like that term, decolonizing the mind. You're right, we hadn't talked about it in those terms before.
It's very interesting, because people naturally will look for in an interpersonal relationship, they will recognize when you make steps towards each other, right? And so they will want to look for likeness. Weirdly enough, even though we focus a lot on groupings in this world, you know, divisions, us versus them, you know, the categorization of identities and all the sets in which we cluster ourselves, and we have clustered the entire world. But really, when you are in front of someone, the initial, at least maybe the soul, I don't know if it's at the soul level, but we actually want to, we are looking for the other person to make the step forward, right? To be the one who come towards us. And so if you're thinking of it that way, the minute that you're in front of someone whose intergenerational suffering you can acknowledge and recognize, or where you can understand that you have a responsibility towards your identity. And when, you know, your whiteness, for instance, is questioned, it's not you personally as your embodied reality, you know, yourself who's put on the wall. It's everything, it's the trauma that you represent. And that trauma is potentially problematic in the interaction with that person. When you clearly position yourself within that, you will really realize the other person opening up. There's really that process that's happening. You know, I can remember countless numbers of times where someone comes to me and will say something, for instance, in a conference where it's Indigenous Peoples Conference, there's no white people, no Western researchers whatsoever. And someone comes to me and say something, hey, don't you feel like a little bit like a fish out of the water or something like that? There's no offense intended at all. It's actually the way that I've come to see it now with, you know, the years and the experience, I don't take these things personally at all. I know exactly where they're coming from. And so therefore I answer with that understanding in mind, and I'll answer something on the same joking mode or something that they don't expect that kind of sets them off a little bit. And usually it's enough for the other person to understand that, okay, this person gets it. It's not one of these, you know, person that gonna take it, that's going to take it bad whenever, you know, I mention her positionality. And this is where you can actually enter that other realm, where you are actually talking from a person-to-person level. Because at first, you know, when you're a white person and you talk to a person of color about issues that are potentially sensitive, you are and you embody the oppressor in that first encounter. And it is your responsibility to show that person that you are not the oppressor in that particular situation. That yes, maybe you benefit from advantages that are inherent to the racial division of labor that your ancestors helped establish. And maybe you personally didn't do that, but you still have a responsibility establishing that in this particular one-to-one situation, you are an ally and you understand what that oppression refers to. That you're not going to take offense, that you're not going to take it bad. This is not the other person's responsibility to take the mental charge of that. And this is something it's, I think, for a lot of white people is really hard to understand.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think that's a big step. That's a big step to take. I've had some interactions with other people, and I wish I could remember his name. He's American, and he's a great didgeridoo player. That's how I remember him. I met him at a Native American festival right outside of Rochester, where there's a Native American historical site. And I think it was the first time I had heard a didgeridoo, and it was just magical. And he learned it directly from the Aborigines. And he said, I can't remember what his job was now, but he was sent to Australia to work with the Aborigines to teach them something. And he said, pretty quickly, they wound up teaching me. And he came back with his knowledge, not just playing didgeridoo, but knowledge about the natural world and how to use resources. And he developed a program and he was training younger people in the States. But I remember him saying, I was sent there to teach them, and it turned around. I stopped doing that. They wound up teaching me. I've read other work by people, anthropologists. I've had less personal contact, but some of the readings that I've done who tell a very similar story. And they went, if not to teach, they went to do research. And but they weren't intrusive. That they could learn from the culture, and little by little, the teachers started to open up and share their cultural background, their spiritual foundation, and would start to share with these people. And they could actually have an interchange about, well, this is what I learned in the West. And then they would have an interchange about, well, this is how we see it over here. And out of that has come some really interesting work. I agree with you that somehow starting from a personal level of knowing yourself, who you are, what you represent just by your existence, and being aware and not being as intrusive or defensive is a way to start, rather than thinking on the big picture, but you actually have to do a lot of personal work. So how has your spiritual interest played into this?
Well, it's actually very consistent with that to me, because my spiritual quest, if you will, and you described a little bit earlier, but it's about understanding oneness, experiencing oneness. And oneness in humanity, or at least at the spiritual level, is very real. It's tangible. People who have spiritual practices know that, and they experience it in different ways and so forth and so on. But it doesn't mean that oneness is reflected at the social level. If you look at the social realm is not really balanced. The social realm that we have on Earth is a social realm of distinctions that are not necessarily salient biologically, but that we have established as sociologically and socially salient. And race is one of them, for instance. We are, and I'm talking about white Europeans here, or people of white European descent, established something called the racial division of labor, which is a way to structure the entire world into different classifications depending on race. And that is actually responsible for the modern shape of the global economy. And the world still functions like this nowadays. And if you don't believe me, there's tons of tremendous work in political economy that will confirm this. But so the world is structured in a way that has put one distinction above others, and that is the social realm, right? The spiritual realm is structured in a way that you and I and anybody else is just part of the whole. So basically, it's a universal aspiration, at least the universal realm is. And I think human beings have universal aspirations, right? Or they think they do, right? That's the spirit behind the Constitution, the spirit behind, the Declaration of the Rights of Man and that type of things, you know, all men are created equal and so forth and so on. Except that the way that we've structured the world is not all universal. It's universalism, the way that white, Western, patriarchal, capitalist universalism looks like. And so that's, to me, the stake that's very much important here is to reconcile the spiritual realm, which is diversity in unison, diversity in unity, with the social realm. And the social realm right now is imbalanced because we have imbalanced it. Human beings have imbalanced it. And therefore, it's that reconciliation. The stake is that reconciliation. So there are two realities existing on two different planes, but the two of them are real. Two of them are real, and suffering, social suffering is real, but unity is real as well. And this reconciliation can be very problematic for a lot of people, depending on what realm they're focusing on, right? I can see that struggle a lot among people with spiritual aspiration who struggle with that concept of distinction.
I guess what I'm hearing is we talk universally, but we don't realize that we're coming from a place of distinction when we say that. It's thinking that, well, my spiritual teacher said to me once, you hang around mystics too much. Most people don't think like this. And I'm thinking, well, how could you argue with anything that we're saying? It's just so universal. So in a way, he was saying to me, the way I took it is, you think that you have the answer, but not only does not everybody think that way, you don't have the answer either. Well, he took a few more years before he told me that one. We have a comment or a question, Brian.
first, I just want to say I really appreciate hearing so clearly about the process of recognizing our stimulus value and decolonizing our own mind interactions with others who perceive us as the other. Could you say something about our duty and the opportunity and maybe what works well with people in our own perceived groups to help advance this process? And I know you're doing some of it now.
Yes. And I think you're right to really differentiate these, because depending on the audience, the work will be different, you know, because if you talk about decolonization in a circle of people of color, most people are aware of it and they're aware of this. This is actually overwhelming. This is a mental charge that they have to endure on an everyday basis. This is something that's very heavy and you don't want to add to that charge. And so your behavior, your reaction is going to be tremendously different. If you're talking to people of the perceived group, as you're talking about, well, in that case, you're facing people who most likely do not understand coloniality, do not understand their role within it, do not have a perception of it, and do not want to get involved in it either. If they are, though, if they're open to understanding, it's already a big step. Because then it means, well, those people just want to know what comes next because they're just lost and they don't really know how to process next. And they haven't traveled, if they haven't seen the world, if they haven't seen or experienced much distinction, it's just very theoretical to them and they don't necessarily see the value to it. There's a lot of tremendous amazing resources in this regard. I really appreciated TED Talk. I would have to find the source here, but it was from this amazing African-American woman who was basically talking about encountering difference. And the best advice she was giving, I was showing that to my students at the time, was to force yourself basically to encounter who or what you consider as the other. That we all have others and they're ingrained in us as part of our subconscious mind and the subconscious colonial reality that's been taught to us. And so we have to extract it out of ourselves, basically. And the best way to do that is, well, think about, very honestly, look within yourself. Who is it that you think of as the other, that you're afraid of? Who are the people that you generalize about? Who are the people that you tend to distrust without no you know, legitimate reason whatsoever? Who is your other? And from that, once you've identified your other, make conscious step towards understanding, encountering, and befriending the other. Basically, rehumanizing the other. So the idea here is that, well, she was explaining the example, for instance, of the skepticism that a lot of people have, especially white people, but against tall Black men. And even her, she was saying, well, even she was talking about an encounter she was having herself as an African-American woman. And she was saying, well, this is so ingrained that even us have this or can have this bias. And so basically encouraging people to, first of all, seeing the other in a different light. So, for instance, educating yourself about who is this other you're talking about, you know, and changing the image of the other. So it's really hard because our media is full of, you know, successful white people and unsuccessful people of color, for instance. That's our media. These are majority of our movies, et cetera, et cetera. But still, you can find most and more dissident resources, you know, about impactful, in this particular case, Black men in history and people who've really changed the world and at the local or the large scale. And there's enough diversity in the world and resources that you can find those, but you need to be really intentional about finding those. And once you've changed your mind about the other and you start thinking of the other as a human again, actually make meaningful relationships with people. It's not enough to, you know, have a Black friend or, oh, there's the Arab guy in the shop that I buy food from. That's not enough. You actually need to have a diverse sets of friends and people in your everyday life that you live with. So in your close circle of friends. And yeah, that's one of the, I think, best educational resource I've seen about deconstructing those prejudices.
So that's a tall order for many of us.
Yeah, but so it's essential when I think of it, and I'm thinking about it while talking, you know, the educational resources we have, it's just mind-blowing. It's mind-blowing. What we hear in our, you know, history books, in our schooling system, the success stories of the world belong to white men. They really do. They still do, you know, and sometimes to, you know, white women, or increasingly to white women. But these are the success stories. I mean, think about it very honestly, right? How many successful or impactful, you know, great men or women of color do you know of, have you heard of? Can you tell me who's the president of, you know, Ghana? Or can you tell me about the history of Iran? Or can you tell me, you know, think about it. What we know of who we call the other, and who we allow ourselves to judge and make decisions about and on and generalize over the entire population on an everyday basis, we know very little about. How legitimate is that, right? Right? Would you allow yourself to have opinion about nuclear physics if you didn't have any education on nuclear physics? No, you wouldn't. Well, it's the same thing with whoever you call the other. We're not allowed to have opinion on the other or generalize about the other without knowing anything about their culture. And I can guarantee you that anybody who has negative impressions on Iranians after experiencing Nowruz, you know, with an Iranian community, and, you know, going to Eid a couple of times and making friends would literally change their minds. That is proven. I mean, these are strategies that work, you know. So that's the only solution to encounter diversity and build whatever it is that we call the pluriverse. The idea that we can actually have a world where distinctions matter in terms of the diversity of humanity, but they don't have an impact and they don't create structural poverty, right? That's what we call the pluriverse in decolonial language.
So one of our Sufi teachers, Murshid Samuel Lewis, Murshid just means teacher. His plan for the Middle East was eat, dance, and pray together. Really, really rather simple. When you eat and celebrate together and some sort of, he called it prayer, but responding to a power greater than yourself, people naturally start to harmonize, and keeping that distinction, that's difficult. We went to Israel several times. We haven't been for a long time, and I don't see us going back. But we went when the U.S. said we shouldn't go, and everybody was really terrified. And it was kind of a pilgrimage. And literally, we had the whole old city to ourselves. There were no tourists. There were a few European tourists, but not many. And so we could walk down and see nobody. And the shopkeepers were begging us to come and browse and buy and all of that. And we found one shop, and somehow we hit it off with the shopkeeper. He gave us tea and did all the things we were getting used to in Israel that you have to do. It's never just go in and buy something. It's a social occasion. And then you have to barter, which is, I just hate bartering. So you had to barter. And so we spent like an hour and we bought a fair amount of things. And then I think the second time we returned was a year later. It was pretty quick. And we went to the same shop and he remembered us. And to our surprise, the shops around him remembered us. And kept directing us, oh, you want him. And then I think we went a third time a few years later, and close to the same thing, only he was hurting more. I think he was struggling more because he really came on strongly about selling us things. And there were some things that we just couldn't do. But I remember somebody, Kathleen, my wife, is just more outgoing than I am. I tend to get really shy and nervous. And somebody, I think it was to me, as I was leaving, one of the other people said, she's a good woman. And, you know, I could really feel the sincerity of it, that everybody knew we were just trying to support the one person we could support, and we'd keep on going back. And we only went back three times, you know, years apart. So there was something, and we would talk about personal things. We found out about his family and his struggles and how frightening it was. But he, of course, was taking care of his family, and he could do the work. And we were just astounded at some of the stories we heard. So yeah, I mean, we felt like we were part of the shop almost. And I think it's not easy to do, but that is the place to start.
You were talking about situations during travel and everything, which again are also situations of privilege, as you're fully aware, that most people are not capable of doing, buying a plane ticket to the other side of the world and do that. And that's great when you can, and that's definitely the approach, but it doesn't have to be to the other side of the world. That's the type of work you can also start within your own local community, and encountering whoever it is that you call the other. In that approach, with the humility in mind to really want to be surprised by what you're going to learn and what kind of friends you're going to make and how your worldview is going to be shattered. I think it's about that. It's about being open to shattering your worldview continuously. And that doesn't necessarily mean you're giving up your worldview and you're saying, well, okay, well, I'm not, my distinctions do not matter. My identity doesn't matter, because it does. And you have the right to your own distinctions. But then you're able to say, well, I'm just going to be surprised by what I'm going to learn and the richness of human diversity, which is incredible, really incredible. And I am one of the very, very lucky ones who got to experience that in multiple occasions across the world. And I cherish that. And I'm fully aware that's part of my privilege as well. But it definitely is the reason why I also acquired that interest in or that awareness of coloniality and the extreme need to decolonize ourselves, for sure.
Yes. But I'll go back to how hard that is, I think, in my experiences for most people, including myself. There was a teacher that I was studying recently who, his advice was, when you're dreaming, you have to dream big. Your dream should be for the whole world, not for you. But changes have to start with you, not with the whole world. Right. I wanted my field of psychiatry to change, but really I had to think of myself as, how am I practicing? How am I interacting with my clients? And, you know, that little piece of advice that parent tried to give me about, there's something you're doing. You're not acting like the stereotype doctor I'm used to. Please don't change that. I think you're right on the money. Kathleen?
My question to Ode is if she could share one of her dreams from childhood that led her forward into her career.
Are you talking about dream as in dream state or dream as in a dream, an idea in a mind?
However you would like to respond.
It's really hard for me to remember because it goes as far as I can remember. People in my family, my closed one, will tell you that I was talking and learning and interested in particularly Great Plains culture since before I was able to read even. So it's a mystery for everybody. But yes, it's as far as I can remember. Everybody will testify.
Thank you.
Sure.
We're going to have to stop in a little bit, but I want you to say some final words about your project and how people can support you, learn more about what you're doing and the work that the Native Lands Advocacy Project is into.
So the Native Lands Advocacy Project started with the acknowledgement of all the difficulties that Native people have to find the information to support their land claims and basically get the ability to regain control and sovereignty over their own lands. And so there's a few projects that we do in this direction. First one is about puzzling together all the history of land tenure. We use a lot of GIS and that type of modern technology to be able to do that. And then the other part is about the participating in the momentum right now about reinventing or inventing new ways of monitoring and evaluating regenerative agriculture and ecological transitions for healthy food systems, climate resilient food systems, and so forth. And so these are two main axis of research that we lead jointly, but it's mostly work. So we do a lot of work that governments should be doing, but they're not. And so we're a nonprofit. It's a very, very humble work with, we hope, a lot of impact. But yes, it's dedicated work, and it takes two passionate people to do that. If you feel like donating or contributing, you can also do that on our website. That's totally feasible. It's work that's, that requires funding, and it's always a struggle.
What's your website address?
Yeah, so it's nativeland.info.
Nativeland.info?
Nativeland.info, yes. And if you're interested in any work that we can do, particularly using GIS, so whether you're a tribal nation or we can tailor solutions for you, we can discuss whatever your needs are, you can contact us. There's also the contact sheet and everything on it. So
you can also volunteer.
Yeah.
Look at the volunteer list and the particular needs they have, and it made me feel so old. I didn't understand anything that they were asking for, so I left. But I wanted to say it's the one about the storytelling that you put together. Part of what really hit me was that first map. So along with the text, there was the map of North America before the Western colonists came in. And the variety, the diversity of the native population spread throughout North America, the many tribes and how they were using agriculture, how they could live with the land, how they were supporting themselves. Nothing like I had been taught in school. And the idea that somehow the Westerners came in and we knew better. And it really was eye-opening to see that map prior to colonization of the United States. And it really hit home.
Yes, for this particular map, I want to give credit to the source. It's this amazing project called the Native Land also, but native-land.ca, and they're based from Canada, and they're doing this amazing world map of all the original indigenous lands. So that's extracted from that. But you're right, it's very much, you know, researchers are realizing how much most of the world was occupied, and the land was definitely used and managed by indigenous people way before any settlers came in. It was just managed in a regenerative way so that the impact on the land was minimum, of the long-term negative impact, the way that we think of impact. And so it's making us really rethink the potential role of humanity in land stewardship and the respect that we owe to traditional ecological knowledge to do that. So it's a very important call for our climate change issues right now.
So thank you so much. It's wonderful talking to you this way, and I know we're going to stay in touch. And congratulations, and more power to you with the work you're doing. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much, everybody.
If you find yourself enjoying our podcasts, please do us a favor and spread the word. Tell a friend about it. Give us a review on iTunes or post it on social media. If you or someone you know would like to participate in a future podcast, please connect with us through the Contact Us page. See our events calendar page for dates to our next live podcast recordings. We'd love for you to participate and ask questions. And be sure to check out Joel Lessie's podcast, Unraveling Religion, on your favorite podcast app. Alchemical Dialogues are live and unscripted conversations recorded on Zoom, brought to you by the great folks of Amber Light International, a nonprofit organization co-founded by Henry Curtella, MD, and Kathleen Fitzpatrick, LCSW. We choose topics from our current social and cultural climate with an emphasis on humanism and spirituality.